behalf of our entire community, I'd like to thank the Fink family for sponsoring this morning's Yom Iyun. L'ilui Nishmas Elimelech by Yitzchak HaKohen, Raja Bas Reb Yitzchak, and Bela Bas Avram. It's really a very special privilege for us to have such an olam here, and to hear Divrei Torah from really two of our most esteemed Rabbanim in a greater community, Rav Shechter Shlita and Rav Tversky Shlita. Neither of them needs an introduction. Each one of them speaks for themselves. Really, without further ado, I can introduce Rav Shechter Shlita, Rav Shiva, and Rav Kolel, Yeshivas Ben Yitzchak Yochanan.
Very often, when someone dies and there's an issue of dividing the Yerusha, it brings about big machlokes, and even if there's hardly any money to divide at all, or even if there are millions for everybody. So, if the laws of Yerusha would be better known, this would help a little bit. Wouldn't solve all the problems, would have helped a little bit. Sometimes people make a mistake. They think that when the rich uncle dies, or when the great aunt dies, whatever it is, and they have no children, so all the property becomes hefker. And kol hakodim zocher. And then afterwards you start to divide the Yerusha. This is not correct, of course. Even if the person who died has no children, no direct descendants, the Yerusha sets in. Whoever is in line to get the Yerusha acquires the property at the moment of the death of the Morish. And whoever takes anything without authorization of the Yorshim is a ganef. The only time the property becomes hefker is if the individual who died is a convert, a ger, who didn't have a chance to make his own, to have his own family yet. So a ger, shin is gar kakot and shin other dummy, he's not related to anybody. And if he didn't get married and have any children yet, so then all of his property becomes hefker. And that is the din that kol hakodim zocher, whoever grabs it is kaina. But if you're not speaking about a ger, speaking about a regular person who died, this is a common practice. An old aunt died who didn't have any children, so the nephews, all whoever happens to be closest, grabs all or whatever happens to be in the house, and then they let the children, they let the aunts and the uncles divide later on. It's totally not correct. we do not follow Dina de Malchusa with respect to the laws of Yerusha. Although the Talmud has the principle Dina de Malchusa Dina, we are obligated to follow the law of the land. The Shulchan Aruch points out this only applies when at least one of the two parties involved is a non-Jew. But if all the parties involved are Jewish, then the Dina de Malchusa Dina doesn't apply. This was always a problem in all the generations, that the Jews always thought, the Balabatim always thought, that Dina de Malchusa Dina. So you divide the Yerusha according to whatever is the secular law of the land. So it's interesting, in the days of Rabbi Yosef Karo in the 1500s, they sent one of the young Rabbanim from Tzfas to visit all of the Arab countries bordering Eretz Yisrael and to explain to the Balabatim that it's not so, that the Dina de Malchusa doesn't apply because all of the parties involved are Jewish. No one involved is a non-Jew. So Dina de Malchusa does not apply. Let me just run through. I remember on one occasion at an OU convention on a Thanksgiving weekend, Taka, a woman came over to me from a prominent Jewish religious family, and she said she has a Shaila B'Yerusha. Do I have a few minutes? I said, yeah. Started telling me a long arichas. It took her 15 minutes till she told me that this nephew did take care and the other nephew didn't visit, and this one did visit, and the other that. It's lamala v'lamara. It doesn't matter who was kind to the great aunt and who was not kind. The halacha says that whoever is next in line to get the Yerusha gets the Yerusha. It's very simple. She didn't know all of that. So it took her 15 minutes till she correct size what the details of the case were that were totally irrelevant, and until she finally told me who's related. And it didn't depend who's related. One of the principles you have to keep in mind is that there are different types of kroivim. The kroivim from the, sometimes you have, let's say, a half-brother who shares the same mother but doesn't share the same father, or you have cousins from the mother's side and cousins from the father's side. So the halacha says that with respect to Yerusha, the kroivim that count are the kroivim who are mishpacha. And mishpacha, the pasuk says in the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar, is only mishpacha sav kri, mishpacha, mishpacha sei meine kri, mishpacha. The pasuk says, lemishpachoisam, leveisavoisam. Only the relatives through the father's side get Yerusha. The relatives from the mother's side are also relatives. That's called share basar. With respect to prohibited marriages, so then you have to investigate which relatives are there from the mother's side that you're not allowed to marry. But with respect to Yerusha, it all depends on the father's side. Take, for example, the following case. This came up in my family. My mother was one of four sisters, and there was one brother. So the brother died. The brother was in the war. Brother was in the American Army in the war, and he was shell-shocked since the 1940s. So he wasn't functioning. He was in and out of hospitals for years and years and years. I didn't know about it. I didn't know when the uncle died. I knew there was an uncle, but I didn't realize he was still alive. He just died a few years ago. So when this uncle died, two of the sisters were no longer alive. My mother and one sister, the two older sisters were not alive. Two younger sisters were alive. Sure. So the uncle left a few dollars birusha, whatever money he was getting from the government for serving in the army and being in and out of veteran hospitals all the years. So a few thousand dollars was left over birusha, peanuts, nothing major, nothing to pay any taxes over. So the aunt who was in charge of the executress of the will, whatever the expression is, so she didn't know the Hilchus Yerusha. So she decided that there were four sisters who were supposed to get the Yerusha. So two were alive, she and another sister. So they get 25% of the Yerusha and 25% of the Yerusha. Right? And the remaining 50% of the Yerusha that goes to the other two sisters should be divided. The other two sisters were not alive, so she made a cheshbon how many nieces and nephews are there. So according to how many nieces and nephews there are, that's how she divided the other 50% of the Yerusha equally. So the nieces and nephews got the equal share. So this is not correct. The din is that each one of the two sisters who had already passed away should be entitled to 25% of the Yerusha. And then you start the cheshbon how many children they have. Let's say if one sister would have 10 children, the other sister has one child. So you don't say, well, there are 11 nieces and nephews, so you divide it into 11 portions, and each one gets 1/11. No, the one sister gets 25%, one sister gets 25%. The sister has 25%, has only one child, so her child gets that full 25%. The other sister has 10 children, so each one of them gets 10% of that 25%. Very obvious. Then there's another din, that if the din in the Chumash is that if you have men and women in line to get Yerusha, if a man dies, a person dies, and there are men and women in line, either children, so their sons and daughters, or there are no children, so there are brothers and sisters, so the men get the Yerusha and the women don't get the Yerusha. So if you have nieces and nephews, so strictly speaking, the din is that the nephews get the Yerusha and the nieces don't get the Yerusha. So my aunt didn't divide it like that, but no one was going to make a fight. It didn't make a difference anyway. So another $5 more, $5 less, didn't make enough kamin. Everybody was happy. Sure. But sometimes chapta enough kamin, millions of dollars, so we're supposed to follow the laws in the Chumash. Of course, today, in Topshin Samach Dalet, and already in the 1300s, this was considered unfair. What it says in the Chumash, that the men get the Yerusha and the women don't get the Yerusha, this caused big friction. So already in the Shulchan Aruch was written in the 1500s, they're quoting from Poskim who lived in the 1300s and the 1200s, that we have to do something to see to it that the women should also get a share in the Yerusha in order that there shouldn't be hard feelings. So in the days of the Shulchan Aruch, the way to solve the problem was that they would give we'll have to discuss how you accomplish this, the way to solve the problem would be that they would give the daughters a share like a half a son. Let's say if it turns out that there are five sons and two daughters, so you don't treat it as if you have, they wouldn't solve the problem by treating it as if you have seven children. They would treat it as five sons and two daughters, they would treat it as if you have 12 children. So each son gets a double share, and each one of the daughters gets a single share. So they would make such an arrangement, as we're going to discuss in a minute, how do you make such an arrangement, that each daughter should get like a chatzi zoch, as if she were a half a child. Today, that probably would not satisfy the hard feelings of the daughters. So today the recommendation is to give the sons and the daughters equal share. So the question is, how exactly does one accomplish this? If the Chumash says that the laws of the Yerusha are that the son gets and the daughter doesn't get, so how does one accomplish that? It's interesting. The Ragachover was a great goyin, super genius, who died before the Second World War. So they were discussing an abstract like chaloymis. What's going to be as mevet machan amedina? we may yet make a Medina in Eretz Yisrael. It was so far-fetched. Rav Soloveitchik said he remembered discussing with Rav Chaim Moshe the possibility of establishing a Medina in Eretz Yisrael. So he said, Rav Chaim Moshe said, yeah, when hair will grow on this side, on the palm of my hand, that's when it's going to be Medina. Rav Chaim Moshe attended the international conferences of the Aguda, the Knesset. In 1937, they were discussing establishing a Medina, all possible, but I thought that it was so far-fetched. Whoever thought that there ever really going to be a Medina? No one ever thought that it was possible. So they asked the Ragat Shavah Vesped Zayin if they'll make a Medina in Eretz Yisrael, and the women feel bad, they don't get any Yerusha, so would it make sense to make a Takana, the government? We don't follow Dina de Malchusa. We have our own Dina. But let's say you have a Jewish government in Eretz Yisrael. Jewish government makes a takanim ipnei tikkun ha'olam. Let's say in America also, the government has laws regarding minimum wages or rent control or similar things, maximum prices you can charge on eggs and cheese, if there were such a thing. So even though it's a goyish government in America, but all of the poskim say that these laws that are made ipnei tikkun ha'olam are binding on the Jewish citizens as well. Even though all of the years ago that was an issue, they used to have Jewish landlords and Jewish tenants, and the Jewish landlords knew that it says in the Shulchan Aruch that Dina de Malchusa doesn't apply whenever all the people involved are Jewish. They used to rip off the Jewish tenants. Jewish tenants would say, "Choking us, you're killing us, you can't pay so much money." So they said, Dina de Malchusa doesn't apply. So Rav Henkin published the tshuva then, 60, 70, 80 years ago, I forgot already how long, a long time ago. They published the tshuva in New York that in this case, Dina de Malchusa does apply. It's the government's responsibility to make takonas, to make life comfortable, that people shouldn't swallow each other up alive. It shouldn't be ish yisrei or chayim baloi. So if the government made such a takona of rent control, the minimum wages and maximum prices you can charge on necessities of life, so then that's binding even on the Jewish citizens as well. So let's say in America, if they would have established, this is not the case, if they would have established a law that the men and the women should get equal Yerusha, so that the women shouldn't feel bad, in order not to hurt the feelings of the women. If that would have been the reason for the din, that's not the reason. The reason is because by the Christians, by them, the din says that men and women yarshin equally. That's how the Gemara says. Rashi says on the Gemara that men and women, as far as non-Jews are concerned, there are laws of Yerusha for the Jews, and there are laws of Yerusha for the non-Jews. So as far as the Jews are concerned, there's a special din of Bechor that the firstborn son is entitled to a double portion. And there's a quirk of a din that the men get, the women don't get. With respect to the non-Jews, they don't have either the din of Bechor being entitled to get a double portion, nor this din that the men take precedence over the women. So here in America, they follow the law, the din HaBnei Noach, that the men and the women, yarshin equally. But if the American government would have instituted the Hakonim of Neitikon Ha'olam, let's say that's what the Ragat Shofar was discussing, if we'll make a Medina in Eretz Yisrael, Yiddish Medina, and according to the Jewish law, the men get the Yerusha, the women don't. So let's say the Israeli government, the Knesset, will pass a law, not Chalila, in violation of the law of the Torah. No, they recognize that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam told us that the men get the Yerusha and the women don't get the Yerusha. And the Bechor gets the Pishnaim, a double portion. But because we're afraid it's going to cause friction, so just like we introduce regulations, minimum wages and rent control and price controls and so on, that people shouldn't harm each other. So to over here, maybe if we'll introduce such a law that the women should get equal Yerusha to the men, so maybe this would be an idea to solve this problem. When we'll make a Medina, the Medina should make such a law that people shouldn't feel bad. For Harai, that it's an issue of Tikkun Olam, that in the Shulchan Aruch they quote, that in the 1300s and the 1200s it was a problem. So maybe if you make such a takon, it'll be binding. So the Ragat Shavah is very upset about this idea. So he says, no, this was always the complaint of the early Christians against the Jews, that the rabbis are cheating the women. Like today, the Reform and the Conservative have picked this up from the early Christians, that the rabbis are always cheating the women, that the Jewish law is always unfair to the women. So he says, what do you mean we're going to make a takon of Neitikon Ha'olam to get the women should get equal Yerusha to the men? He says, Das schmeckt von Christianity. If a person wants to make his own deal, he wants to make some kind of a tzavoya that his daughter should get an equal Yerusha to the sons, gives them to hate on a private basis, he can do such a thing. But he says that the whole Medina should make such a takana, he thinks that that's a terrible idea. So on the Shulchan Aruch, they discuss people solving the problem on a private basis. How does one solve the problem on a private basis? That the daughter shouldn't feel bad. So the Mishnah in Bava Basra speaks about the institution of a tzavua, that a person has the ability to leave a tzavua, to make a will, and to divert the Yerusha. Even though in the Torah the Yerusha should go in one direction, if a person makes a tzavua, he can change it. In fact, the poskim recommend that when a person reaches the age of 50, they should make a tzavua. Because you never know when you're going to die. They say this based on the pasuk, Bishnasa Yavel Hazos Toshuvu Isha Lachuzoso. The pasuk speaks about the Jubilee year in Eretz Yisrael. When it comes to Shnasa Yovel, so whoever sold real estate that he owns in Eretz Yisrael, that's a Stei Achuzo, that he got Birusha from his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, so if you sold it to someone else, when it comes the Yovel year, so you get it back. Bishnasa Yovel Hazos Toshuvu, everyone returns back Isha Lachuzoso to his Stei Achuzo. So the Achreinim use this pasuk and as a melitza. When a person reaches the jubilee year of 50, they should start thinking about returning back to their maker. Toshuvu isha lachuzosai, and they should make a tzavur. I remember my sister-in-law told us once, she was so petrified, she married a daughter of one of the great Talmid HaChachamim. So she said when her father-in-law reached the age of 50, so they had a little birthday party at home, and her father-in-law said he made a tzavur. And she thought it was tzavua, at the age of 50, what's he making a tzavua for? What does he think he's going to drop that already? He's healthy and so I said, he's just following what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. She didn't know that. She thought that he was so nervous, he was so afraid he was going to die. So in Shulchan Aruch, they recommend like that. Everyone should make a tzavua when they reach the age of 50. So the Mishnah derives this from the Pasuk in Chumash. It says, the Chumash gives a description of a man who was married to two wives, not necessarily at the same time. It just says he has a child from one wife and a child from the other. It could be the one wife after the other. So it says, he was married to two different wives. One of them he likes, the other one he dislikes. And each one of them has a child. And the Bchor was born to this Niyot, to the wife that he didn't like. Or according to the rabbinic interpretation, it's not that he doesn't like that wife. The marriage was a prohibited marriage. Let's say Kohen married a Grusha. So that's called snua. That's snua ben isuah. That's a forbidden marriage. The kohen marries a regular girl. That was okay. And they have a child. And the kohen marries a grusha. And the child is going to be a cholol. And lo and behold, the child who's the cholol, he was the firstborn. So he's entitled to the double portion. So the Chumash says, you're not allowed to cheat him. Even though that was the forbidden marriage. And even though that child is a cholol. But still, sof kol sof, bottom line, he is the pchor. So the pchor is entitled to the pishnayim. So the Chumash uses an expression, v'hoyom, when it will come to be, when the father is about to give away the Yerusha, so he's not allowed to cheat the Bchor. That's how the Pasuk says. So what kind of an expression is that? When the father is about to give away the Yerusha to the children, who's about to give away? The person drops dead. The Malach HaMavis takes his life and he dies. And surely he doesn't give away the Yerusha. Well, I decide to give away the Yerusha. When the father is about to pay lois the Yerusha, who's telling us Yerusha? So the Mishnah says, you see from the Pasuk, you see from the Chumash that the Torah gives the father, whoever it is, the right to make a tzavua to determine who should get, not in accordance with the laws of the Torah. So that's the mocker, that's the source in the Chumash for the institution of making a will, that the Torah does authorize the person to make a will and to change the rights of Yerusha a little bit. So this is very, very restricted. This principle of tzavua is very limited. First of all, the Mishnah says that tzavua only helps if it's bein bein abanim, if a person has a few children. So all of the children should get, let's say, an equal share. And he has, let's say, he has five children, and two of them are very, very successful in business, the multimillionaires, and the other three are sitting and learning, and they're just making a living, barely making a living. So he says, instead of all the five children getting 20% of the Yerusha, he wants that the two multimillionaires should get 5% each, and the remaining 90% should be divided among the others. He says he wants to give $20,000 to each one of the multimillionaires, and all the rest of the Yerusha should go to the others who could use it. So the Mishnah says, since they're all in line to get something anyway, so if it's bein bein abanim, or if he doesn't have any sons, he only has daughters. So again, some of the daughters are married to wealthy people, and the others are poor. So he wants to give more Yerusha to these daughters than to the others. But all the daughters are in line to get Yerusha. So then he can change the laws of Yerusha a little bit with his tzavor. But he's going to say, Abbas b'makam abein, if he has sons and daughters, and he says, I want all the sons and the daughters, everyone should get equally. So the tzavor isn't going to help, because the daughters are not aligned to get a penny, so they don't get anything. Or he say, he leaves in his tzavor, he wants his next door neighbor to get some money, or his good friend, the gabbai always gives him aliyas and shul, or whatever, the two gabbaim. This gabbai is going to give a Yerusha, the other gabbai is not going to give a Yerusha, because he gives him aliyas, he doesn't get, whatever. So the gabbaim are not his children, they're not in line to get any Yerusha, so the tzavor isn't going to help. It only helps if the person is in line to get somewhat of a Yerusha, so then you can make a tzavor that he should get more. Secondly, the Talmud is not sure when this applies. It could be that the principle of tzavor biyom hanchilo azbanov, that HaTorah nostam shus la'ab l'hanchil l'chol mishir, so the Torah gives authorization to the man who's about to die to make a Yerusha. Maybe it's only when he's literally about to die, when he's a shchiv meira. Maybe when he's healthy, when he's 50 years old and he makes out that tzavor and he tells the children at his birthday party made out of tzavor. So maybe then the tzavor is not valid. The Gemara is not sure. Maybe there's a concept of shchiv meira. Shchiv meira means a person who is sick and not a goses. A goses means one in whom the process of death has already begun. Shchimra means a person is sick in bed, and there is a possibility that he may die. So the Talmud says that we're not sure. It could be that this principle of tzavor only applies biblically, only applies if the individual is a shchimra, which is usually not the case by us. Usually people make tzavor way before they become a shchimra. So that's why this biblical principle of tzavor doesn't really help too much. So we have takonis midirabanan that help a little bit, but also don't solve all of the problems. We have a takonis midirabanan that appears in the Gemara, that mitzvah lekayem divrei hameis. If a person left instructions while he was alive and healthy and kicking, what they should do with his money after he dies. So the Talmud says that midirabanan, we are obligated to follow the instructions that he left. So Tosis points out there are so many Gemaras that speak about people who left instructions what should happen with the money after they die. And the Gemara says you don't honor their requests. So how could that be? What happened to this principle of mitzvah lekayem divrei hameis? So you must say that it's limited somehow. You have to restrict it in some sense or another. Tosis gives quite a few different suggestions. So the suggestion that is accepted in the Gemara never says clearly what the limitation is, but it's clear from the Gemara that there are limitations, there are restrictions. So the opinion that's accepted in Shulchan Aruch is that this principle of mitzvah lekayem divrei hameis only applies in cases of hushlash mitchila lekach. If the person, while he was alive, gave the money over to somebody else. If I left all the money in my bank account, well, everything is on my name, and then I leave instructions after I die, I want them to do this, that, and the other thing. But I never gave over the money while I was alive. So then this mitzvah lekayem divrei hameis doesn't apply. But if I gave over the money to a lawyer, or I put it in a special escrow account, that lachamev esm shonan, they should do this and that with this money, then you have this takana midirabona, that mitzvah lekayem dirameis would apply. No, most of the time it's not hushlish mitchil lekach. Most of the time when people make tzavos, people make a secular will, so they don't give over the money. The money is still in their name. All the money is in their bank accounts on their name. So you don't have this hushlish mitchil lekach. Rab Chaim Eiser writes in one of his tshuvas, if a person leaves the tzavua to leave money to tzedakah, then he thinks this would be binding based on the principle of mitzvah lekayem divrei hameis, even though the accepted view in Shulchan Aruch is that mitzvah lekayem divrei hameis only applies when it's hushlash mitchila lekach, if he handed over the money while one was alive. So he says, we have a principle, this is really a biblical principle with respect to tzedakah, that amirasa lagavoa kimsirasa lahedyadam. The original Mishnah is with respect to Hegdish. That if a person says, I want to donate this building to Hegdish, I want to donate this automobile, I want to donate my furniture to Beis HaMikdash, so the din says this is not just a neder, it's not just binding because he took a neder. What if he says, I want to donate this to the Beis HaMikdash, and he drops dead right away? So once he's dead, meisim apota from fulfilling all of the nedarim. But the din says that it's not just a neder that binds him. The din is that by making such a statement, I donate this to Hegdash, it already belongs to Hegdash. That's what the Mishnah formulates in principle in Kiddushin. Amirasa la gavai, when a person makes an oral declaration towards Hegdash, gavai means Hegdash, kimsirasa la hedyadam, as if he had handed it over to another party. Just like if you do misir, if he handed it over, that's a kinyan. So making an oral statement, an oral declaration, also accomplishes a kinyan. and the Hegdish is Kona. So in Shulchan Aruch, the accepted opinion is that this principle of Amirasa Lagavoya Kimsirasa the Hegidomi, the accepted view is that it's not restricted only to Beis Hamikdash, it applies also to Tzedakah. That was a big issue in the 1500s. It comes up today also. Let's say there are some people only come to shul three times a year, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and then they pledge get an aliyah. And then they pledge they're going to give $10,000, and they're not going to show up in shul till next Rosh Hashanah. So they got a whole year. They think they got a whole year to pay that pledge. The din is that there's a halacha bal ta'ache. He's supposed to, if the shul needs the money, he's supposed to pay up the money immediately. And even if the shul doesn't need the money, you have to give the money before the next yontif that comes, sukkahs. But the people who go to shul only three times a year, they don't know all these dinim of bal ta'ache. So a fellow thinks he has another year till he's going to buy seats for next Rosh Hashanah. He got plenty of time to pay his pledge. Then he dies in the middle of the year. So the question is, are the yorshim, are the children obligated to pay the nether that the parent had accepted upon himself? See, if one would have said, Amirasa la gavoya kimsirasa la hed yedomi, that making an oral declaration accomplishes a kinyan is restricted only to Hegdish, and as far as tzedakah is concerned, it's a neder tzedakah. So neder is fine, kolzman, the person is alive, the neder is binding. Gishtorben and gishtorben. Once the father dies, so he's not obligated to fulfill his neder, and the children are not going to fulfill the neder on behalf of the father, even though it's going to give this money to tzedakah. The father died and he never fulfilled the neder, so nothing will be accomplished. But if you should assume, that's how we paskin in Shulchan Aruch, both in Yeridei, Hilchas Tzedakah, and Choshen Mishpat. We paskin, Amirasa Legavoya, Kimisirasa Lehed Yedomi, applies also to Tzedakah. So this was in the days of Rabbi Yosef Karo with the Ramor. Rabbi Yosef Karo lived in Eretz Yisrael in Tzfas, and the Ramor lived in Krokke, in Poland, and they corresponded. This is one of the issues that they corresponded about. A person took a neder, a large sum of money, and he died before he paid the neder. So the Psak Halacha was accepted that Amiros al-Gavah does apply to Tzedakah. It's considered Kimsiros al-Hed Yedomi, and the Shibud was Chal, not just Mitam Neder, the Shibud Mamanus was Chal, and the Tzedakah has a right to take the money even after the person died. So that's what Chaim Moshe writes in his Tshuva, that because we assume Amiros al-Gavah Kimsiros al-Hed Yedomi applies even to Tzedakah, so when a person makes a tzavoy that he wants to leave so much money to this tzedakah, to that tzedakah, to the other tzedakah, this is binding, even though the tzedakah is not aligned to get any Yerusha. So the law, the principle of tzavoy doesn't apply. It's not bein ben abonim, but it's binding because of this principle midirabonon of mitzvah lekayim dirameis. This is considered like hushlash mitchila lekach. Since Amirasa lagavah is considered as if he made a kinyan, as if he gave over the cash. So if you would have given over the cash while you're alive to someone to hold on behalf of the tzedakah, that would be binding, that agreement would be binding mitam mitzvah lekayim dirameis. So even though he didn't give over the money, amirasa lagavoy with respect to tzedakah is considered kimsirasa lahedya. Rav Chaim Moshe, that's in the regular tshuvas of Achiezer, Rav Chaim Moshe. Then in the additional tshuvas after he passed away, in Bnei Brak, they published additional tshuvas that he didn't have a chance to put together. And in one of the later tshuvas, Rav Chaim Moshe raises the possibility that if a person made a secular will, and let's say if you live in America, once you make a secular will, there's no way in the world that if you go to court, the court is not going to honor the secular will, unless you're going to prove that the guy was off his mind at the time that he made the will. Okay, it's very hard to prove. But if the person was normal and healthy at the time that he made his will, so then the will is binding, and the government, the civil court, will not care about the fact that it's not in accordance with the Jewish law, and all the people involved are Jewish, and din in the machusa doesn't apply. The government will pass, and according to the din in the machusa, they will honor the will. So Rav Chaim Moshe raises the possibility that if one made a secular will before he died, maybe that's considered the equivalent of hushlish mitchila lekach, because he put his money in such a situation by making the will that it's impossible to shake this will. Maybe that, he's not sure. Maybe that should have the status of hushlash mitchila lekach. So because Rav Chaim Moshe is not sure, so that's why we don't rely on that alone. See, under normal circumstances, let's say a person makes a will, and he didn't make any kinyanim, the will wasn't binding according to halacha. But then when he dies, he has children. So Rabbi Akiva Iger writes in his tshuvas that there is a mitzvah of kibud av v'yem, stach from the Aseres Adibus. This week's sedra about the Esav had the big schus of kibud av v'yem. Yanka was away in the yeshiva sitting and learning. He was never mekayim kibud av v'yem. And Esav, with all the rishis that he had, Esav had my love, kibud av v'yem. The Medrash speaks a lot about that, that Esav had that schus. So there is a mitzvah of kibud av v'yem. So Rabbi Kivege writes in his Shuvas, if a person dies and he leaves a tzavua, and the closest relatives are his children, so mitam kibud av v'yem, the children are obligated to honor the tzavua that the parents made. And then Rabbi Akiva Eger writes that even though the rule is that kibud av v'yem is mishalav velo mishalbein, let's say my father says he'd like to go visit Eretz Yisrael. So I said, go. Okay. Go gezenta. He says, no, he wants me to arrange for it. I said, good, give me your credit card and I'll arrange. He says, no, kibud av v'yem. I want you to use your credit card. So the Gemara says, I'm not mechuyev. The Din says that if my father can afford it, which Baruch Hashem he can, if my father can afford to pay for his own trip to Eretz Yisrael, so I'm not mechuyev to spend money. If you kibud av v'yem is mishalav, alo mishalbein. The children are not mechuyev. Kibud doesn't mean to spend money. Kibud means you stand up, you service the parents. That's one thing. But to spend money, nish mechuyev, unless the parents don't have. That's a different story. But if the parents have and the children have, so the children are not obligated to spend money. So Rabbi Kiveger raises a question. Gitazog, he makes a statement in his tshuvas that mitam kibud av v'yem, the children have to honor whatever will the parents made, even though it doesn't correspond to halacha. But once the father dies, once the parent dies, so the Yerusha goes to the children. So you're telling the children that they're mechuyev to give away their money? It's their money now. So why are they mechuyev to give away their money mitam kibud av v'yem? So Rabbi Kiveger says, no, but the money at the time the father made the will, money belonged to the father. So the father has a right to give instructions to the child. This is my money. And when I die, I want you to share equally with your sisters. I want all the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, everybody should get an equal share. Whatever tzavua, whatever crazy tzavua the father has in mind to say. So Rabbi Kiveger writes that everything is binding me tam kibud av v'yem. Yeah, this is nice if you have children who are interested in fulfilling kibud av v'yem. If you have large sums of money involved, they may not be so keen about observing kibud av v'yem, and they may decide they want to go to Din Torah. Then the Torah is not going to force the child to observe kibud av v'yem. That's one of the mitzvahs that we don't force people to fulfill. The Gemara has a whole discussion about that, why, but if a person doesn't want to sit in sukkah, doesn't want to shake a lulav, we force him to keep the mitzvah, if we would have a Jewish government. But kibud av v'yem, we don't force anybody to keep the mitzvah. So that's why in the Shulchan Aruch, the recommendation is made that you got to make it legally binding. So in case they'll go to a Din Torah, you won't have to rely on the good mercies of the child that is going to really be interested in fulfilling kibud av v'yem. If there's a lot of money involved, he may decide to violate kibud av v'yem. So this is the question Rabbi Chaim Oizer raised, a question he's not sure. If you made a secular will to give money to private individuals, even though they're not in line to get Yerusha, so maybe since the government will not honor anything else other than that secular will, and if they'll find out about this will, they will certainly enforce it, so maybe that's also the equivalent of Hushlish Metchila Lakach, but he's not sure. So that's why he recommends we should avoid relying on that. We have another principle in the Talmud that also rarely applies. The Talmud has another Takonim de Rabbanan, another rabbinic enactment that when people are sick and holding by dying, so sometimes they'll get so nervous about narishkeiten that they'll aggravate themselves to death and this will hasten their death. So sometimes the Gemara says a person is sick on his deathbed, or even not holding by the deathbed, a shchiv meira. Shchiv meira is not a gosei. Shchiv meira means he's laying in bed, he's sick, he's not walking around. And he's so concerned, what's going to be? I may die, and the money's going to go to this one, to the other one, to the other one. He's nervous. So his aggravation over the money may hasten his death. So the rabbis made a takana. The Mishnah records this takana. If a person is sick, and he gives instructions, he wants this money to go to so-and-so, so we say, don't worry, even though we didn't make any kinyan, the money already belongs to Pliny. If the fellow recovers, he has the right to back out, because we assume that he only made this gift. He only gave he says, I want to give my home to so-and-so. Then he recovers. So where is he going to sit? Where is he going to live? So it's understood that any matonis that he gives in the state of Ishchid Merah are only on the condition that he's going to die, that he ultimately dies from this sickness. But if he gets better and then he gets sick again a second time, so whatever he said before he got better is canceled. If Hebrew, it doesn't apply. Yeah, so there is such a principle. If the person is sick on his deathbed in the hospital, and then he says, I want all the daughters to get an equal share to the son, that would be fine. That would solve the whole problem. That's Divrei Shchid Merah Kiksuv V'Mechim Sirin Domei. But by most normal people, when they're about to die, they're not thinking about the Yerusha. They made a will a long time ago, and they don't repeat what they wrote in the will when they're about to die. A lot of people die suddenly also, so you can't rely on that, on the Dirish Chimera Kiksuvim Chim Surindami. So that's why in the Shulchan Aruch, as I mentioned, the Shulchan Aruch was written in the 1500s. So in the Shulchan Aruch, they quote from the Poskim who lived in the 1300s, that if a person wants to see to it that his daughters get Yerusha, he wants all the grandchildren to get an equal share or whatever, so then he should make such a statement and make kinyonim. He should have someone make a kinyon. It doesn't make sense to have the daughters there and make a kinyon with the daughters, that the daughter is going to give a handkerchief to the father, in exchange for which the father now obligates himself to give each one of the daughters $100,000. The daughter's going to say, okay, pay up now. So what does he do if the daughter says, man is only 50 years old. He's going to live another 70 years. Has a long time to go. So if he's going to make his chayvus now to give, or let's say he decides wants to give everything to his wife. So his wife may say, so give me the money right now. She wants all the money right now. So the Shulchan Aruch recommends you have to make such a kinyan now, but he should say that the obligation to give this amount of money should only be collectible at a later date. When? At which later date? So if he says, I obligate myself to give, let's say the man is 50 years old and he wants to leave all of his assets to his wife, but he doesn't want the wife to clean him out right now. He's not holding by dying yet. So he should say he obligates himself to, let's say he doesn't think he'll ever have $5 million. That's the furthest hasog. He'll never earn so much money. Even if he lives another 70 years till the age of 120, he's not going to have $5 million at the time that he dies. So he let him say, his wife should give him a handkerchief, a kinyan suit, and he says, I obligate myself to give you $5 million, which is in excess of what he thinks he will ever earn. I'll never earn that much. But then Mimele, she's going to get the whole Yerusha later on. Fine, the children will get the Yerusha, but the father obligated himself to give his wife all this money. So the wife takes all the money. But then he does want his wife to clean him out. So he says, but the debt should only be collectible after I die. So if he would word it like that, I obligate myself now to give you $5 million, but only collectible after I die. So then the Gemara says that's not meaningful. Ein king elahamisa. If you have something that's supposed to take effect after the person dies, so that's not meaningful. So you have to say the king should take effect while I'm still alive. While he's still alive, so he's afraid the wife is going to clean him out. So in the Shulchan Aruch, what they recommend is the husband should, let's say he wants to give to the wife. So he says, I obligate myself to give my wife $5 million. It should only be collectible the day before I die. So you never know when it's going to be the day before he dies. After he dies. So she can never come to court and sue him and say, I want my money. I want my $5 million. She can't clean him out. So after he'll die, then the wife will know that yesterday she was entitled to the $5 million. Okay, so that'll solve the problem. But the Shulchan Aruch raises an issue. This is what we traditionally refer to as an issue of Breira. If a person makes a kinyan that's supposed to take effect at some time in the future, and we don't know exactly when that moment of time is, and we're only going to know this in retrospect after the person dies, then we're going to know when the day before he died was. You never know in advance. So at the time that the wife is getting the rights to collect the $5 million that he's not going to have before he dies, at the time that she's getting the rights, we don't even know that she got the rights. After he'll die, we'll know that yesterday she was entitled to this amount of money. So based on the Gemara, we should really say that Ein Breira, we paskin with respect to Dinim Deraisa, Ein Breira, you can't have a kinyan. Let's say a man gives his wife a get. A man has no children, let's say, has no descendants, and in the event that he dies before his wife, the wife will need chalitza, and his brother's a meshugan, and the brother doesn't want to do chalitza. So how does he solve the problem? So let him give his wife a get. Give his wife a get, but he wants to live with his wife. He's happily married, doesn't want to give his wife a get. So no problem, give your wife a get, and say the get should take effect after you die. Get takes effect after he dies, meaningless. You can't, and get lahamisa. You can't give a get now that should be chal after he dies. So give a get and say, I want the get to take effect the day before I die. So the Gemara says that's not good. The get is trying to take effect the day before you die. You'll never know when that is. After he dies, we'll know that the get took effect yesterday. So the Mishnah says that's not valid. That's called Ein Breira. With respect to Dinim Deraisa, Ein Breira. You can't say that something takes effect now, because tomorrow we ascertain that it took effect yesterday. It has to be known at the time that it's taking effect. So that's not valid. So how does the Shulchan Aruch write that this is acceptable? That the husband, let's say, makes a kinyan with his wife, He obligates himself to give his wife $5 million, which he's never going to earn so much in the next 70 years till he dies. And then he says the money should only be collectible the day before I die. It should be a violation of Ein Brera. So the Shulchan Aruch paskens that this is acceptable based on Aran and Adorim. Those who learned in Dorim, all Arans are very long in Adorim. The Aran always writes a very bariches. So there's one of those very long rhymes in the beginning of Perek HaShutfim. In the middle of Nedarim, there's a very long essay that the Aran has that the only time we paskin Ein Brera if it's on the major aspect of the Kinyan. Like the man gives a get to his wife, when the get takes effect, that's a major issue. When is she allowed to remarry, when not? But if it's on a minor aspect of the Kinyan, then we say Yesh Brera. So the Shulchan Aruch assumes that this is considered not the major aspect of the Kinyan. The man obligates himself to give his wife the $5 million as of now, but it's only collectible. Even if he's obligated now, she doesn't necessarily have to come to collect it now. She'd be a nice wife. She'll wait till after he dies. She knows that this is only a gimmick that she should get the Yerusha. Because Allah says the wife doesn't get the Yerusha, only the blood relatives. The wife doesn't Yerusha the husband. So she knows that the whole purpose of this is that she should get the inheritance. So the fact that he determines she should have this chus to collect this $5 million the day before he dies, that's considered a detail in the Kinyan. It's not considered that major an aspect of the Kinyan. So therefore we paskin in such a case that yesh brera. So that's the solution that the Shulchan Aruch has. Whenever a person wants to change the Yerusha in such a way that the Tzavua isn't going to help, because he wants to give it to someone who's not aligned to get any Yerusha at all. He wants to give everything to his wife. He wants to give it to the daughters. The daughters should get an equal share with the sons. So the daughters are not aligned to get anything. If he has sons, Abbas b'makom banim, the daughters are not aligned to get anything. And the divrei shchibmirah kiksuvim chimsurim doesn't apply. It's not a shchibmirah. And mitzvah l'kayim divrei meis doesn't apply either because it's not hushlos mitchila l'kach. So the way to make it is you make your secular will, and then you make a kinyan with someone gives a handkerchief to the person who's 50 years old, to the birthday boy, and by his accepting it, and the other person is giving it relying on the principle of zochen liyadam shloi b'fonam. You don't require that the wife and all the daughters and all of the people should give a handkerchief to me to make the kinyan. We do that at the wedding all the time. The kala is sitting in the other room, and the rabbi gives a handkerchief to the chas, and he says, I'm representing the kala. By my giving you the handkerchief, you are now obligating yourself to give your wife the Tosefes Ksubin and the Dunya, these large sums of money. The Kala is not here. But based on the principle of Zochen Liyadam Shloi B'fonam, someone else can give a handkerchief on behalf of the Kala. So here also, you have someone, either the Jewish lawyer or the rabbi, somebody gives a Suda, someone gives a Kli. It doesn't have to be a handkerchief, it can be a gartel, it can be a ballpoint pen, whatever, a pair of glasses, whatever you want. You give some kind of a useful Kli to the man who's making this Tzavor. And you say, whatever you have in your secular will, we're making kinyonim now, that all of this is binding mitam kinyon. And of course, you reserve the right to back out. If you ever change your mind before you die, you have a right to back out the kinyonim or Allah tonight. That's the recommendation in Shulchan Aruch. I just wanted to spend a few minutes to speak about one aspect of Yerusha that's not really so well known. The halacha says that the Bechor, the firstborn son, is entitled to a double portion. So the Mishnah points out this only applies if it's the firstborn son. If it's the firstborn, let's say there are 10 daughters and one was born before the others, or I have 9 children, my oldest is a daughter. So the daughter doesn't have a din of Bechor. I have sons and daughters. Let's say there would be 9 girls. So the oldest daughter is not entitled to Bishnan. The din of Bechor only applies to the sons, doesn't apply to the daughters. Now this din of Bechora, that the Bechor is entitled to Pishnayim, so the Mishnah has a limitation, a restriction. The Bechor is only entitled to a double portion, as it reads in the Chumash, Bechol Asher Yimotzei Lo, whatever assets the father has at the time of his death. Let's say the father doesn't have the asset yet at the time of his death. The assets are Ra'ui. For example, you have Avram is a millionaire, Yitzchak is a millionaire, and they both die, and Yankif and Esav are fighting about the Yerusha. So let's say, for argument's sake, that Yaakov is the Bechor. Let's leave out whatever the truth is. Let's say Yaakov is the Bechor, and he's entitled to a double portion, and Esav is only entitled to one. What do you mean a double portion? So So instead of, what does it mean a double portion? So it means, let's say, if you have Yaakov and Esav, instead of dividing into two and each one gets 50-50, you treat Yaakov as if he were two sons and he's entitled to two-thirds and Esav is entitled to one-third. Let's say there would be nine children, nine boys, and one is a b'chor. So pishnaim doesn't mean that the b'chor always gets two-thirds. Pishnaim means you treat him as if he were two children. So if there are nine sons and one is the b'chor, so you consider it as if there were 10 sons, and the b'chor is entitled to two-tenths, and each one of the other eight sons is entitled to one-tenth. That's how the Mishnah explains. The conservatives made a whole big spiel about this. They said that originally the biblical law was that the b'chor always gets two-thirds. That's what the meaning of pishnaim is, and the rabbis changed it later. We don't have any evidence that this is the case, and therefore, just like the rabbis changed the laws later because they saw it's not working out, so we today have a right to change all the laws also. We have absolutely no shred of evidence whatsoever that the din ever was different. The Talmud presents it, that's the way the din always was, that pishnaim doesn't mean two-thirds, pishnaim means a double portion. If there are two sons, then it turns out to be two-thirds. Instead of considering as if you have two sons, you treat it as if you have three sons. If you have nine sons, so you make believe as if the b'chor were two people, so you treat it like 10 sons. And the b'chor gets two-tenths, and each one of the other sons gets one-tenth. So again, the Chumash says, the b'chor is only entitled to the pishnaim, the double portion, in the assets that the father has at the time of death. So let's say, for argument's sake, this is not what happened. What happened was that first Avram Avinu died, and then later Yitzchak Avinu died, and then later Yaakov Avinu died. Let's say, for argument's sake, Avram Avinu outlives his son Yitzchak. Avram Avinu is a multimillionaire, and Yitzchak is a multimillionaire. So Yitzchak dies, and they divide the Yerusha between Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov gets two-thirds, and Esav gets one-third. After Yitzchak dies, then Avram Avinu dies. So who gets the Yerusha? So Yitzchak Yarshins. Yitzchak is not alive. That's called Yarshins Bekever. And he transmits the Yerusha from Avram Avinu to two sons, to Yaakov and Esav. So regarding Nichse the Avua Da'ab, or the assets that belong to the grandfather, that Yitzchak didn't have at the time that Yitzchak died, he didn't have Avram Avinu's assets yet because Avram Avinu outlived him. So then everybody agrees that the B'chor is not entitled to Pishnaim. Since Yitzchak didn't possess those assets at the time of his death, so the B'chor doesn't get Pishnaim, they divide it equally. Each one gets 50%. The Talmud has a dispute among the Tanoim. What if it's not Nichse de Avua Da'aba? What if it's not the assets that Yitzchak never had yet while he was alive? What if Yitzchak was a wealthy man and he lent out money? He was very kind. He lent out money to everybody, to the Jews and the non-Jews and the neighbor. He lends money to everybody. And he never collected back these assets, never collected back the halvois until after he dies. So when they collect the halvois after Yitzchak dies, is Yaakov entitled to a pishnaim on that or not? You say, Yitzchak had it. He had that money. He earned the money, and he lent it out to people, and they owe him the money. So the Yaakov should be entitled to pishnaim. But he say, no. Lemaise, the money is only collected after Yitzchak dies. So since they didn't have the actual cash until after Yitzchak died, so that should be considered ro'ui. So that was a dispute in the Tanoim. And the accepted opinion, halacha lemaise, is that Yaakov is not entitled to pishnaim. Yaakov only gets 50% on that. So this is the major issue regarding money in the bank account. Money in the bank, if you have a safe deposit vault, if I put all of my money in my mattress, I'm a multimillionaire, I have all the millions of dollars in the mattress. So the money is sitting in the mattress. I have a safe deposit vault. When I earn my $1 million a week, my yeshiva salaries, I put it in the safe deposit vault, I put it in my mattress. So then when I die, so the poor gets pishnaim. The money is there, it's sitting there. But if the money is not in a safe deposit vault, it's not in the mattress, I put it in the bank. What do you mean put it in the bank? It means I lend it to the bank, and the bank does whatever they want. They spend it, and they owe me this money. It's not sitting there. So the money in the bank is considered a halvor. Or let's say if you have government bonds, or if you have bonds in a corporation. So it's also a loan. They're not holding on to your dollar bills or to the check that you gave them. It's a loan. They're going to spend the money when you're going to ask for it later on. So they give you back the money. So al pi pashtus, this should be considered a halvor. This is a regular halvor. So halvor we consider ra'ui as opposed to muchzak, and the b'chor is not entitled to pishnaim. So this was a big machlokes in the days of the Nodi Yehuda. This halacha that we have accepted the view of Rebbe and the dispute between Rebbe and the Chachamim, we follow the opinion of Rabbi Yudah Nasi, Rebbe's opinion that a halva is also called ro'i, is not considered muhzak. What if the nature of the halva is such, not a halva that I lent to a private person. I'm going to say I need the money, so he's going to dilly. He may dilly-dally and pay him back, and may take me forever till I get the money back. It's money in the bank. Money in the bank. You come to the bank and you say, I want to take out all the money from the bank, so they'll give you all the money. Legally, I think they don't have to give you all the money. I think you have to tell them in advance, a day in advance. More than $5,000, I think they're not mechuyev to give you back. But lemaase, if you come to your bank and you have $50,000 in your savings account, you come. You say you want $30,000, I'll give you the cash. You give it the money right away. They'll give you something today. They won't give you a hard time unless you want $1 million. So they say, look, legally you had to tell us a day in advance. Okay. But they usually can get your money back. Or let's say you bought government bonds or something like that. So you can take your government bonds, cash it in the bank whenever you want. So that was a big machlokes. The one who asked the shaila of the Nodi Behuda thought that even though that's also halva, that should be considered muhzak. That shouldn't be considered roi. Because there's no question that he's going to collect it. The bank is federally insured. What, the bank is going to go bankrupt? It's federally insured. Of course he's going to get his money back. So that should be considered muhzak. The Nadi Behudib is of the opinion, no, a halvoa is a halvoa, and all halvoas are considered rotwi. So that's a big shaila halacha lamaisa today. Many of the contemporary poskim think that we should not poskim like the Nadi Behudib. We should poskim like the one who sent the shaila. They say Rav Moshe Feinstein felt like that, the Aruch HaShulchan writes like that. Many think that we should accept the view of the shoyl in the Nadi Behudib. The people who sent the shaila to the Nadi Behudib are also big Talmid HaChacham. So usually we follow the tshuva of the Nadi Behuda, but once in a while we follow the shoyl, the suggestion that was brought to their attention. So many rabbanim in our generation hold that if it's money in a bank or if it's a government bond or something like that, that of course I know I'm going to collect it. It's positive that I'm going to collect it. So that should be considered muhzak, not considered roi. Today, let's say if you have money in a savings account and you have a card that you can push in, you can go to the bank at 1 o'clock at night and push your card in and take out $1,000. So that for sure is muhzak. There's no shy. I don't even need the good graces of the teller to give me the money. I can take out the money on my own. So that's for sure muhzak. That's not considered roi. The whole shaila is if I come to the bank and I have to ask him, pay me the money. So that's a machlok. But for sure they're going to pay. The agreement is that they have to pay. So that's a dispute whether it's considered roi or muhzak. This issue, whether it's roi or muhzak, is relevant for the b'chor, where it gets to pishnayim. And in fact, that's how the rabbis in the Talmud interpret the story that appears in the Chumash regarding the daughters of Tzolofchad. They came and they asked the shaila that the father passed away, left no sons, and only left daughters. Are the daughters entitled to the Yerusha? So that's the simple meaning of the pasuk. So the rabbis of the Talmud say that's not the shaila. Moshe Rabbeinu knew and the daughters of Tzlovchad knew that whenever there are no sons, the daughters are entitled. Well, what? The money's going to become hefker. It's going to go to the cousins. Why should the cousins get if there are daughters? Of course the daughters get. The shaila that they asked was a different shaila, the Talmud explains. That Tzlovchad was the firstborn of his father, Tzlovchad ben Chefer. He was the oldest son. So as being the b'chor is entitled to a double portion of whatever the father has. But what did the father have? A garnished. He had a... When they were traveling in the Midbar, who had anything? A couple of trinkets that they picked up when they knocked on the next door neighbor's doors on Erev Pesach before they left in Bezus Hayam, Bezus Mitzrayim. There wasn't so much there. But the question was, what about the real estate in Eretz Yisrael? When HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avram Avinu, Kum Hisalech Ba'aretz La'orka L'rachba Kilucho Tzinen, walk around the borders of Eretz Yisrael, and I will give it to you. So the question is, was that a promise in the distant future? Someday in the future, I will give you Eretz Yisrael. When Yeshua ben Nun will conquer the land, then I'll keep the promise. Then I'll fulfill the promise of giving you Eretz Yisrael. Or was it not a promise? It was a statement right now. Walk around the borders of Eretz Yisrael. And by doing so, you will acquire ownership of Eretz Yisrael. So the Gemara says the difference is, did Chefer, the father of Tzlovchad, did Avraham Avinu already own Eretz Yisrael? So when he died, he went to Yitzchak. When he died, he went to Yaakov. When he died, he went to the Shvatim. When they died, he went to their children. So Chefer already owned this real estate in Eretz Yisrael. So when Chefer died, Tzlovchad was entitled to a double portion in Eretz Yisrael. Or should I say, no, this was just a promise. It wasn't yet fulfilled. Fine, the Rabban Shlom is good for his promise. He's good for the money. He's going to deliver later. But since no one had it yet, Avram didn't have it, Yitzchak didn't have it, Chefer didn't have it, Tzlovchad didn't have it, nobody had it. Since it's just a promise, so then I should consider it ra'ui. So that Slavchot should not be entitled to a double portion in the real estate in Eretz Yisrael. Should only be entitled to a double portion from whatever the father had in his possession at the time. So that was, the Talmud says, that was the question that they posed to Moshe Rabbeinu, whether Eretz Yisrael already belonged to Avraham Avinu, so therefore it's Muchzok, so therefore it's Slavchot was entitled to a double portion in the real estate, or it's only Roy, it was a promise. And Moshe Rabbeinu answered, the double expression. Yes, they are entitled to a double portion. That Eretz Yisrael is machzaka simi aviseinu, mimois Avraham Avinu. Eretz Yisrael belongs to the Jewish people from day number one, from the day that Avraham Avinu walked around the borders. So again, so this issue, many quote that story in the Chumash to show that if the women pressure long enough, so the rabbis will give in to the women's pressure on the women's issues. So the rabbis in the Talmud understood it had nothing to do with women's issues. The rabbis say they always knew, that like Slavchad knew, and Moshe Rabbeinu knew, and the Rebbe Shlom knew, that they all knew. When there are no sons, so the daughters get the Yerusha. That wasn't the issue. It says, Nason Titein, so it's a giveaway, means the Shiloh was the Pishnayim. Was Slavchad entitled to a double portion in Chayfer's Yerusha, because in Eretz Yisrael, that was the Shiloh. Is Eretz Yisrael Muchzok, or is Eretz Yisrael Roy? So this doesn't come up that often, the issue of the Pishnayim, the Bchor is entitled to a double portion in the Muchzok as opposed to the Roy. But what does come up is that there is a din that the husband yarshins the wife. If the husband wives the husband dies, the wife does not yarshin the husband, unless he made such an agreement, such a tzavo in advance. But if the wife dies, then the din is that the husband yarshins the wife. So there is a limit, there is a restriction. The husband only yarshins the wife of Muchzok and not Beroy, whatever assets the wife had at the time that she died. Let's say after the wife dies, then her father dies, and her father's a multimillionaire, so the husband doesn't get that Yerusha, only whatever the wife had. So the Shaila is, what if the wife had a lot of assets, but everything was money in the bank, or everything was government bonds, or corporation bonds? So these are loans. So we pass in Aloha that a loan is considered Rawi, it's not considered Muhsin. But this is the Shaila, what if it's a government bond that you go to the bank, you can collect it right away, or it's money in the bank, you can collect it right away? So that's the big issue that often comes up, halacha l'maisa. I remember many years ago, the first time I visited Eretz Yisrael, there was a big din Torah in Tel Aviv about such a case, that a woman was an almona, she was married to a prominent Rosh Yeshiva in America, and then her husband passed away, and then she went to Eretz Yisrael, and she remarried. She married a very prominent rabbi in Eretz Yisrael, and then she died. So the Shaila was, her second husband wanted to get all of her Yerusha. And the children that she had from the first husband, she had no children from the second husband. She was in her 60s when she remarried in Eretz Yisrael. So the children from the first husband wanted to get the Yerusha. So the second husband said, no, the din is that the husband gets the Yerusha. So the Shaila was, but she didn't have the money stuffed in her mattress. She didn't have it in a safe deposit vault. The money was in a bank account. And the money, at that time, the bank accounts gave interest. The money was in the government bond, American government bonds, not Israeli government bonds. So she had the bond. So the Shaila was whether money that's in a bank is considered Roya Muchzak. So that's a major Shaila. There was a large sum of money. Recent years, I wanted to find out what the Psak was and that in Torah. So because the second husband was a very prominent figure in the Rabbanut, somehow they covered up the whole case and there's no record at all that such a case ever came up. They tell me they don't have such, no one alive remembers that there was such a, I remember seeing the documents, that they had such a din Torah in Tel Aviv. So he said, no one remembers that there was such a case, they don't have it on file, they don't have any psak on the case at all. These are an outline of the rules of Yerusha. The main thing is that if a person makes a tzavoy, he has to make it clear to the children and to all the relatives who's getting what, so there shouldn't be any machloikis later on. And he has to see to it that he gives, he should leave over the whole Yerusha to his wife. That makes more sense. He should leave the whole Yerusha to his wife. And if there is no wife, the wife is going to feel awful if he doesn't leave the Yerusha to the wife. And if there is no wife, then he has to see to it that he gives an equal share or a significant share to the daughters as the sons. And the Shulchan Aruch, they recommend you have to do this, otherwise it's going to cause tremendous friction. Even by the most observant, by the most religious people, if the father could be the biggest tzaddik in the world, if he's going to follow the din Torah, the daughters will never forgive the father why they didn't get an equal share with the sons. So the Shulchan Aruch recommends that to make peace in the family, that's what they should do. The father should make these kinyonim to see to it that everything should be done in a reasonable fashion. Okay.